Dr. Benjamin Spock spoke on Friday, February 19th, at Cy Melby Hall on the campus of Augsburg College in Minneapolis. The doctor had just gotten to the stage when he was upstaged by a group of feminists who preempted his talk.
We quote from Dr. Spock's latest book, Decent and Indecent, published in 1970. Quote, women on the average have more passivity in the inborn core of their personality. Quote, a girl is not as apt as a boy to become fascinated or particularly interested in such abstract subjects as math and later physics and law. Her deep confidence that she will bear children leaves her in the average case less preoccupied than the boy with trying to become great artist, inventor, discoverer. Quote, I think that when women are encouraged to become competitive, too many of them become disagreeable. Quote, okay. Quote, men have the ability to analyze a problem. That is how they become more often than women, inventors, discoverers, builders, unquote. This reinforces the stereotype that women are emotional and men are rational. Quote, more women wanting to go to work will continue. They have every right to do so as long as the children's emotional needs are thoughtfully met, unquote. This totally ignores men's ability and responsibility to develop the skills to fulfill these needs. Quote, women are usually more patient as unexciting, repetitive tasks. Quote, these qualities make women indispensable as wives, mothers, nurses, and secretaries, unquote. How convenient that these ideas of women's nature fit so remarkably the common prejudice and serve men, industry, and commerce so well. We as feminists felt it necessary to react to Dr. Spock's presence here tonight because he is an outstanding advocate of the status quo with regards to women's traditional role in our society. In this respect, he is not even a liberal. He is a reactionary. Dr. Spock acknowledges that innate differences between males and females are impossible to determine, but goes on to treat all the differences inherent in our society as being innate, institutional, and inevitable. I believe I have time to speak here. I'd like to finish. It is certainly true that different traits will be inevitable as long as Dr. Spock and the status quo continue to treat them as preordained truths of human nature. If the peace movement is truly concerned with ending the domination of all peoples, it is imperative to go to the root causes of these ills and confront the day-to-day aggression of the male sex over the female sex, which Dr. Spock passes off so easily as natural, needing only to be controlled. We do not accept the popular definitions of what is masculine or feminine. It will be necessary for men to change their destructive aggressiveness right here in their own lives and homes before they have the right to denounce national domination. We can no longer allow people like Dr. Spock to speak of a man's need to be in control and in authority over women as acceptable social behavior. This condones in our society the very values which the peace movement claims to denounce. We do not recognize Dr. Spock as a legitimate spokesman against a war, which is the natural extension of the sexual domination he defends.
Mock Spock, a choral reading sponsored by feminists throughout the world. The doctor speaks. Women are usually more patient in working at unexciting, repetitive tasks.
We love no repetitive work. We love no repetitive work. We love no repetitive work.
The doctor speaks. Women, on the average, have more passivity in the inborn core of their personality.
We average women were born passive. We average women are passive. We passive women don't want to be passive anymore. Is that okay?
The doctor speaks. I believe women are designed in their deeper instincts to get more out of life when they are not aggressive. I think that when women are encouraged to be uncompetitive, too many of them become disagreeable.
We promise not to aggress. We promise not to compete. We promise not to disagree.
A boy should know that his father enjoys his company in a special way because they can talk about cars, carpentry, or sports.
Snakes and snails and puppy dog tails, that's what boys are made into. Snakes and snails and puppy dog tails, that's what boys are made into. Snakes and snails and puppy dog tails, that's what
I think
boys
this is
are made into.
The doctor speaks. A girl needs from her father compliments on the attractiveness of her appearance, in her skill in feminine occupation, particularly in her thoughtfulness and helpfulness.
Sugar and spice and everything nice, that's what girls are made into. Sugar and spice and everything nice, that's what girls are made into. Sugar and spice and everything nice, that's what girls are made into.
A witch's hex.
You've heard Ben Spock proclaim our praises in slippery, liberal, fraudulent phrases. We're lovely mothers, lovely wives. He knows just how to live our lives. He's another man to give us blues because we're still not free to choose. Serving his whims has become a bore. We've been errand girl, nursemaid, mother, and whore.
Girls are walking out. The doctor is joining in the applause.
Get a draft card.
Right on. We fought in three wars already.
Yeah,
read your history books.
Would you listen to a racist speaker?
Dr. Spock brought
the
millions of families.
That's the answer, you.
Later. On behalf of the Minnesota 8 Defense Committee, I would like to introduce Dr. Spock and welcome him back to Minnesota. Dr. Spock still is concerned about his children, and he has come here tonight to lend his comfort and to support some of them. Thank you.
I ought to at least explain myself a little after the demonstration. I thought it was a very well organized demonstration. I think they had some very good points. Let me confess that I wrote that part of Decent and Indecent between 3 and 4 years ago when Women's Lib and what it stands for was hardly visible on the horizon, but I think I should have obviously, in retrospect at least, done more revising before it was handed into the republisher about a year and a half ago. I think the main thing I think also say, partly and certainly at least an unconscious sexist in having assumed, like everybody did up until a few years ago, that women would take the larger part of child care. Obviously, this is a prejudice, but a prejudice based on what's happened everywhere in the past. But I agree that is a prejudice and that should not hold any longer. I think the main thing that I would say in self-defense is that they, of course, selected the things that I said that would seem to limit woman's role, but actually in other parts of that chapter I said women should be able to do any kind of work that's available, that they want to do, that they should be equally trained, that they should get equal pay. And I should also say that those aren't just words, that two of the most important jobs I've had in my career were I served under women bosses. So I think that it's not just that I have words about women should be able to get anywhere, but I think I was able to live that kind of career and was very happy and proud to serve under those women. So I don't think that it's quite fair to imply that I think women should only be held down. I think also if anybody wants to, it's old stuff now, look into that chapter, that unfortunate first half of chapter 2 in that book, they'll see that most of the criticism is the characteristics of males, because what this book is about is not just chit-chat. The book is about how are we going to save ourselves, and what I spent a great deal of space on was the unfortunate impulse of men to save face first or to hit first and then find out the right and wrong of a situation afterwards. The pathetic need to prove virility that shows in so many aspects of male behavior. Well, anyway, I'm not trying to beg off altogether. I think that I was wrong in some of the things that I said. I obviously carried over prejudices from the past, as most of us have. I hope that I'm willing to learn. I would only say finally that for the last 3 months I've been revising the first half of chapter 2 of Decent and Indecent, especially before it came out in paperback where it might be bought by students. And I think I've cleaned it up considerably. Only time will say whether it's clean enough to pass muster. Anyway, I agree that women won't get their just desserts. Women won't get equal pay, equal opportunity for promotion until they protest and protest vigorously. That's what we found in every other aspect of modern life that's wrong. People aren't going to give you things until you show that you're going to insist and keep on insisting. So I agree entirely that there should be women's liberation and that it should be vigorous, very militant in its assertion of rights, and it's only after these assertions have been made and rights granted and new ways of living, including within the home, tried out, that we'll be able to come to conclusions later about whether there's anything inherent about these differences that I was so casually talking about, or whether they were all imposed by society. Well, we should get on then to now. Get on now to dissent and social change. I think that dissent is extremely important. I think that our country is sliding toward disaster internally, and that we're going to continue to be on the edge of nuclear war in our external relations until we get a drastic change in all the attitudes of a majority of our people, and I'm afraid that's going to take a long time. I think until that time comes, dissent is going to be a very prominent feature of American life, and it's good for us to stop from time to time and review our dissenting. How far do we feel entitled to go, with what means, over what issues? I found myself in the last 3 years that I've changed considerably every 3 months, so that it does no good to come to conclusions about dissent. You can't think that you've solved it forever, but at least I can't. I keep changing, finding it necessary to become more radical. As you know, I've been reproached by people like Spiro Agnew and before him Reverend Norman Vincent Peale for corrupting the youth. I would be proud if I were responsible for some of the great changes, the demand for a better world, the idealism that makes young people willing to devote more of their lives to working for humanity rather than just for salary and advancement. I'm not trying to tell anybody here how far to dissent. I'm only saying let's talk about some of the aspects or angles of dissent. And then after a while, let's get to some good discussion. I hope that when we first get to it, that'll be some of the people who sharply disagree with me who get most vigorously into the discussion. In other words, I don't want wishy-washy discussion. I would like good, peppery discussion. I first, of course, have to mention the issue over which I got dissenting and got into a little trouble about it. The war in Vietnam, because I think it's a very good example of how wrong a society, a nation, can come in its aims, and how absolutely essential it is for those who consider the nation wrong to dissent. I believe that the United States was never invited into Vietnam by anybody except our own puppets begged us not to go because they knew they'd be put to death if we didn't stay around to protect them. And I believe that we didn't go there as a result of any treaty obligation, though our presidents keep referring vaguely to this. There is no treaty obligation under which we're in Vietnam. We went there as a power grab because our government under Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles in 1954 thought there was a chance of our succeeding in controlling South Vietnam the way the French failed. We promised first, after the defeat of the French in their 8-year war to reimpose colonial control, we agreed first to abide by the peace treaty, the Geneva Accords, which specified no foreign interference, country only to be temporarily divided, not for political purposes, and within 2 years, 1956, there was to be a nationwide election in which the people were to be entitled to be reunited and choose a government of their choice. And our own president, Eisenhower, said everybody that he consulted on Southeast Asia agreed that if we'd allowed the election to be held that we promised not to interfere with, 80% of the people would have voted for Ho Chi Minh, the hero of North and South Vietnam. We found our first puppet in the United States, transported him, his name was Diem, transported him to Vietnam and set him up in the puppet business. And we might have gotten away with it if he hadn't turned out to be one of the most tactless, arrogant, paranoid leaders of modern time that absolutely drove his people led to despair. He canceled the election, he canceled the village elections, He took the land away from the peasants among whom Ho Chi Minh had divided it and took it back from the peasants and gave it back to the absentee landlords, the upper class landowning people. He filled the jails to overflowing and had people tortured and put to death. And eventually, 6 years after we installed our man, the Vietnamese people so despaired of ever getting justice that they started the Viet Cong revolt in 1960. That was our first illegality. We had no damn business being there. We broke our sacred promise to abide by the Geneva Accords in moving in there. And after the fighting broke out, our president then, Kennedy, should have, according to our promises to the UN, submitted this threat to the peace to the UN. But as is characteristic of our country, it only submits to the UN those disputes in which it's pretty sure that it can embarrass the other side, and keeps out of the UN those disputes in which it might be, it has the muscle to do so, in which it might be embarrassed. So that's the second illegality. We broke our promise to the UN. Then Johnson got himself elected in 1964 on a promise not to escalate the war or send Americans to fight there. And as some of you may know, I'm just as ashamed as about that second chapter in Decent and Indecent. I campaigned in 64 very actively on radio and television for Lyndon Johnson. So much so that he called me up 2 days after the election to thank me. And then he said in this voice that sounded so humble, though you and I know now there was not a scrap of humility in Lyndon Johnson, he said, "Dr. Spock, I hope I will be worthy of your trust." And I, who had no idea yet that he was going to betray us, said, "Oh, President Johnson, I'm sure you will be worthy of our trust." And it was only 3 months later that he betrayed millions of us and made a monkey out of me and some of the other people who campaigned for him. That in doing so, he broke his promise to abide by the Constitution of the United States, which says only Congress can declare war. He said the Tonkin Gulf Resolution was the equivalent of war, was the equivalent of a declaration of war, but the Senate Foreign Relations Committee under Fulbright eventually found that he committed fraud in getting this resolution out of Congress. He said there was unprovoked attack by the naval forces of North Vietnam and the naval forces of the United States, and he asked for authorization to repel such an unprovoked aggression in the future. Well, the records of the Navy Department, when Fulbright finally got him 2.5 years later, showed that the United States Navy had equipped, trained a Saigon naval force, which on that first week of August 1964 was making unprovoked attacks on harbor installations of North Vietnam with not only the full knowledge of the United States Navy, but the active cooperation of the United States Navy. And then our country, unable to make any progress in spite of the fact that we and the Saigon forces had a 6-to-1 numerical superiority in troops, total air superiority, and considerable conventional weapon superiority, unable to make any progress, basically because all the people who had guts and patriotism were on the other side. The people on our side are the same Mandarin class Vietnamese who fought on the side of the French when the Vietnamese were fighting for their independence. The land-owning people who know that if we stay, they can have their economic privileges, but that if we go, their land will be taken away from them and distributed. And that's why they're fighting on the side of a foreign invader. Then our country takes to wholesale violations of the laws of warfare. We began poisoning crops wholesale to try to starve the people into submission. This is forbidden by international law. We began destroying dwellings by the torch, by the bulldozer, and by bombing. And this is forbidden by international law. And we removed the people from their homes and the graves of their ancestors and put them in what amount to concentration camps in the hundreds of thousands. And this is forbidden by international law. What this adds up to is not a slightly immoral war, a slightly illegal war. It's one of the dirtiest wars that's ever been fought in the history of mankind. And I think that our government has a nerve saying that such people as the Minnesota 8 and the Boston 5 and all the young men who've gone to jail for refusing to participate in such dirty work, the government says we're the criminals, and all we've been doing is pointing out that the war is totally wrong. There's not the slightest legal justification, and the young men and the older men call attention to the Nuremberg Principle. That's the principle by which we put to death Germans and Japanese as war criminals. And in their trials, they said all we were doing was obeying the orders of our superiors. And you know, our American judges, French judges, British judges said, that's no excuse. If you knew you were being asked to commit crimes against humanity, you're not only permitted, you're obligated to refuse to obey those orders. And our government, our courts refuse to even allow this to be mentioned in the courtroom. There's no precedent for it. So our young men go to jail for doing what our judges said in the Nuremberg Principle, any young citizens of a country should and are obligated to do. I'd like to drop the war in Vietnam for a minute and go on to some other examples of the question of dissent. And I'd like to mention next, what is this law that the establishment types are always invoking when young men resist the draft, when people march on the Pentagon in a demonstration or go to Chicago to demonstrate, or when black people in their desperation get rioting. The establishment types insist law and order must be restored at all costs. Well, a very interesting article, I thought, comforting to me, was written by a Professor Sachs of the University of Michigan Law School a couple of years ago, who points out the law isn't quite as neat. It isn't a nice integrated circle of laws the way the establishment types would have you believe. He says, remember, only a small minority of the laws are ever being enforced at any one time, and it's purely the discretion of the prosecutor or the policeman who happens to be offended by somebody's behavior. Then he arrests the person or prosecutes them and finds a law to invoke. But other times, other groups who don't happen to offend the police, and Sachs gives the example of American legionnaires at a convention get away with murder, the sort of thing that young men, if they tried for 5 minutes, would be pinched immediately, clubbed, and put into a jail. Sachs also makes the point that there are tens of thousands of laws, a majority of which conflict with other laws in the United States. And you often have to, if you've got determination in your belief that you're right, and if you've got money, I should have to mention that you need some money too. It's one of the things that I've learned in this last few years. Justice is not blind, giving equal justice and absolute justice to everybody. You gotta have a good lawyer or a whole batch of good lawyers if you're gonna get justice out of the courts, and this takes a lot of money. I asked today how much money has been raised for the Minnesota 8, and they said in the neighborhood of $9,000, and I remember my own trial, I was one of five, my own personal expenses were $80,000. Fortunately, I started with one lawyer, and in order to do the job right, he brought in four other people, and fortunately, I had friends and supporters who raised most of that money. Otherwise, I'd be paying it off for another 10 years. Anyway, he says, if you want to fight your case up through the hierarchy of the courts, remember that even when you get to the Supreme Court, it's very difficult for these most wise judges to decide what is right and wrong, because a great majority of their decisions are split decisions, 5-4, 6-3, and so on. Then he adds one nice thing that comforts me. He says, remember that the Supreme Court reverses itself, giving the example of an earlier Supreme Court that said separate schools for black children are equal, and then in 54, somewhat more honorable, I'd say, Supreme Court says, oh no, it can't be equal, otherwise why did they create separate schools? Well, my hope is that some decade, maybe between wars, some court in the United States will dare raise this question of whether an illegal war isn't as illegal in the United States as it is in the as in other countries. Sachs, in writing this article, and I, in calling attention to it, don't imply for a minute that a society can get along without laws. Furthermore, you have to have general respect for the law. He's only making the point it's not as neat as the establishment types and the authorities would have you believe. And maybe you're right, even though the government has gone after you and said that you're wrong. I think this brings us to the next topic, how slow the law often is to catch up to what's considered justice. And I just want to give you three examples. One is women's suffrage. You know, women began demanding the vote in the middle of the 19th century, and they used all the prescribed means, writing letters to the president and their congressmen and senators, and participating in, through their husbands in political campaigns. Educational campaigns, and women not only got nowhere, they were laughed at for thinking that they should be given the vote. And in the 20th century, they became indignant enough at what is so obvious to them an injustice, in which we would all agree today, of course it was a preposterous injustice. It was then they began smashing windows, knocking the heads off statues of our heroes, and lying down in Pennsylvania Avenue to obstruct traffic. And these weren't young girls. These were society matrons, so-called, from Boston and Philadelphia, cities where women take their rights seriously and aren't afraid on occasion to be a little obstreperous. And then, and only then, did Congress say, well, maybe women have a point after all. And then they started the woman suffrage amendment. Another example is labor's right to organize and to strike, generally denied labor in the United States until the mid-1930s. All that an industrialist had to do was go to court, get out an injunction that more or less paralyzed labor's efforts. Labor tried all the prescribed means, political pressure, educational campaigns, got nowhere. And then in the mid-1930s, they got so indignant that they discovered and had the courage to use the sit-in strike. And it turned out strategically or tactically to be a very powerful weapon, because if 5,000 men in a factory decide that they're just going to stay there indefinitely without working, it would take something like 15,000 police or 15,000 troops to get them out of there, and there'd be bloodshed. And then there would be political repercussions. And when labor used this somewhat illegal, though certainly a non-violent means, then it made Congress stop and ask, well, is labor getting justice? And they decided, no, it isn't getting justice. And then they passed the Wagner Labor Relations Act. Third example is the American Revolution. Our forefathers thought taxation without representation is tyranny, and it sounds like a small issue compared to some of the injustices of today, like the injustices of black people, I would say. And they tried all the polite prescribed means to get relief from England and got nowhere, and they finally began dumping tea in Boston Harbor and started a full-scale revolution. And the American Declaration of Independence, which is one of our most sacred documents, says in so many words, if people can't get justice through the prescribed means, then they're entitled to start not a sit-in, they're entitled to start a revolution. Very strong language. Lincoln reiterated that and more recently, Supreme Court Justice Douglas was threatened with impeachment, you remember, for putting it in a book that he'd just written, that the American people have the right to rebel if they think they aren't getting justice from their government. Well, I didn't come to the Twin Cities to start a revolution, though I respect those who think revolution is the only solution. I happen to believe myself that though the injustices are enormous, the collective injustices at the present time, I happen to be one of those who believe that we haven't half tried the prescribed means. If you want an example of what I mean, I would say relatively few thousand young people almost got Eugene McCarthy the presidency, and if a quarter of the people who find the war abominable were willing to work in the campaigns of peace candidates, we could entirely change the complexion of Congress. No question about it in my mind.
Lyndon Johnson?
Now I want to go on to some other examples of dissent that are a little more controversial and a little more recent than the American Revolution. The first one is the Democratic Convention of the in Chicago a couple of years ago. Seems to me those 8,000 or so young people who went there had every legal and constitutional right to go. This is the right of petition to the government. And I would say that Mayor Daley was totally wrong in denying them a permit to march to the convention to present their views, and quadruply wrong to unleash his police. If there are people here who believe that unleash is too strong a word, I would remind you that the President's own Commission on Violence said, after careful investigation, it was a police riot. This is not to say there was no provocation, but that it was predominantly a police riot. I would also remind you that back in the spring of 68, there was bold talk of 100,000 American peace people of all ages going to Chicago to demonstrate, and at that time, Mayor Daley made it absolutely clear that he was going to treat anybody rough who came there to demonstrate, and that was exactly the reason that most of the old people dropped out, including me. I found excuses, and my wife helped me to find excuses why I couldn't go to Chicago that summer, and now I'm ashamed because I think that it was one of the real battles of the war to end the war and to strike a blow for the right to dissent. And if there had been some graybeards and more matrons in the ranks of the demonstrators, Mayor Daley might have been a little more reluctant to unleash the police. But if he did just the same, when the television cameras saw not only young people in jeans being beaten, and there is terrible prejudice against young people in jeans, if there had been matrons and graybeards, then the people watching television might not have been quite so ready to say those kids had it coming to them. Shocking the way that trial was, the trial of the leaders was carried on. To me, one of the horrors, a really fascist kind of a trial, and it read badly enough in the paper, but when you went there to visit and saw that judge smiling, doing a sort of a dancing cranes minuet with the prosecution, always turning hostily on the defendants and on their lawyers, you saw the reason why they began to be disruptive and disrespectful after a certain number of weeks and months went by. I think more alarming than anything else is the fact that that the law under which those leaders were prosecuted, the so-called Rap Brown Law, was passed only a few months earlier by a Congress, I would say absolutely unnecessarily. Most lawyers that I've talked to said there was no need for a federal law to punish those who cross state borders to cause a riot. Most of them say that's clearly an unconstitutional law anyway, because how can you have it in your head to start a riot? I would say those people did not go there. Perfectly obviously, they went there to protest. But it was, it seems to me, a purely vindictive and a suppressive impulse on the part of the Congress that made them pass that law. They wanted to be in on the act of knocking down people like Rap Brown, who were talking in too uppity a way. This is characteristic of the way our government behaves, it seems to me. Instead of facing the terrible wrongs that people are protesting against, instead they ruthlessly try and beat down the dissenters. If you think that's a lone example, I remind you that Congress has recently passed a Preventive Detention Act, clearly unconstitutional, and by which the judge in the District of Columbia can keep in jail, deny bail to a person who otherwise is entitled to bail because the judge imagines that he might commit another crime, clearly punishment in anticipation without any trial. Let me move on, because I want to discuss more briefly two other examples of dissent that I think bring out very important aspects of it. One is, and I apologize for the fact that they're very Eastern examples, as you well know. I'm a provincial Easterner, and I might as well confess it. I happen to know people at Columbia involved and at Harvard involved, and that's why I take the examples. At Columbia, there were a number of issues, as you remember, about 3 years ago, but the one that in the end was paramount was protest against Columbia University's unfair, harsh treatment of its poor tenants, the people who lived in the buildings on Morningside Heights owned by Columbia University, and they do own most of the real estate there. A very small number of students said, at a time like this, when we're beginning to recognize how badly we've mistreated Negroes and illegally so in the last 100 years, a great university should lean over backwards to treat them decently. But when Columbia needed one of these buildings for its own use, it unceremoniously evicted its black tenants and took no responsibility in finding substitute housing. This small number of radical students protested again and again. They protested most indignantly at the time when Columbia was beginning to build a Columbia gymnasium on a small piece of city park property, one of the small areas of park available for the poor, crowded people of Harlem. They lay down, the students did, before the bulldozers trying to stop them and dramatize the issue. Then, when nothing else succeeded, they finally occupied buildings. As you know, President Kirk called in the police, who first removed them without too much difficulty, and then they beat them out on the campus in such a brutal way that there was a violent reaction in the faculty as well as the student body. And a few months later, the trustees of Columbia, instead of firing the students, fired the president. They fired Kirk. The other example at Harvard, the issue was ROTC. There's a small number of radical students who said, at a time like this, when a great majority of faculty and students think that the war is abominable, and when the Defense Department is supporting more and more university research, including research on chemical and biological warfare, a university should wipe the slate clean and say it's not a business of a university at a time like this to be involved in the teaching of killing, even in an indirect way. And they asked that they asked that ROTC no longer be a department, an academic department of Harvard, though they didn't object to it staying on as an extracurricular activity. And they appealed to the administration that always gave them the brush off. They appealed to the faculty, and the faculty had a resolution that was tabled, and it stayed tabled for months with no action being taken. And these students, having tried everything else, decided to occupy a building, and President Pusey, as you know, called in the police, who first removed them and then beat them bloody in Harvard Yard. They got them down there, and they beat them and beat them, and there were pools of blood, and it caused such a violent reaction that within a few weeks, The Faculty of Arts and Science of Harvard University voted 285-25 that ROTC must be removed as a department of Harvard University. And I think both of these, in a sense, were extraordinary. They, at least at the time, they seemed extraordinary successes of movements started by a very small number of students. I think it's worthwhile stopping for a minute to ask, how did this small number achieve so much? I think that the answer is that if you're in any small minority that's protesting against injustice, the first and the biggest job is to get the majority to pay attention to what the issue is. To put it the other way around, people have a protective mechanism to keep themselves from going crazy so that they try to keep from being involved emotionally. They try to keep from seeing and hearing, and more importantly, feeling injustice. It's this rather than, it's not that there's a majority of cruel or heedless people. They protect themselves, and you have to break through that shell. And if you'd allow me to psychoanalyze the other students and faculty at Columbia and Harvard, I think at Columbia, when they saw their own friends, their real friends, lying down there being beaten, it suddenly made them realize this is just what black people have been getting for 350 years in the United States. It became real for the first time. And I think at Harvard, when they saw their friends being beaten, they suddenly realized this is what the Vietnamese have been taking. They've been really dying and shedding real blood, and it made them realize this can't be. We've got to protest more strongly. I'd like to mention several degrees of dissent, because I think in the minds of too many people, dissent is merely civil disobedience or violence. I think many of us would feel that at a certain point one is entitled to go from legal to civil disobedient dissent, and at a certain further point, most of us, I think, would feel entitled to go on to violence. But I want to make the point that there's a variety of forms of dissent that are completely legal, which I don't believe are being used. And I'm ashamed to mention the first one. That's writing letters to the president and to the vice president, not the vice president, never mind the vice president, the president and your senators and your representative. I would put it this way, that if a tenth of the people who find that this war is abominable would take the occasion every 2 to 4 weeks when there's a new outrage like the enlargement of the war into Laos to write a letter, the president would be getting something like 50,000 letters a day. And this would scare hell out of Richard Nixon to get any such number. I would put it another way, that it's unfair to him for us to seem to be silent so that he can go around with that suave smile as if he thinks he's got us all persuaded that Vietnamization is the answer. I've been terribly distressed that even in peace meetings, people who join peace societies and were willing to spend a whole day at a peace workshop, you ask those people, have you ever written a letter to the president? And half of them have never written a letter. And you ask them, how come, you know, you don't get investigated by the FBI unless you threaten the president's life? Your neighbors don't need to know that you're taking a position, and all it costs is about a total of 8 cents, something like this. And you know, you get answers from people like, well, I wouldn't know exactly how to express the letter, or I wouldn't know how to address the envelope. And you have to explain to people, the president doesn't call in the Secretary of Defense, show him a batch of letters and say, look at that spelling, look at the punctuation here. The president doesn't even see the letters. But somebody has to count them, and if there's an appreciable number, they are obligated to tell the president about it. And we ought to keep the president aware all the time by tens of thousands of letters every day saying, I'll never vote for you again if you don't bring this war to a complete conclusion and bring all the troops home by the end of 71. I when people say I wrote once or twice and it didn't end the war, so therefore there's no point in writing, I would say it means you haven't written a tenth as many letters as you should. I always assume, I write at least every 2 weeks, and I assume that the president discounts these, that he's heard that I'm opposed to the war, and he probably thinks that this is a sort of a routine professional attitude on my part that makes him yawn. But what we need is millions of people whose names aren't known to the president, who we can think of as potential Republican voters. And you don't have to tell them you didn't vote Republican the last election. All you have to say is, in the coming election, I'm not going to vote for you unless you end this abominable war. Political activity, of course, is extremely important, not just voting, but working. And again, I would refer to the few thousand young people who worked so devotedly and nearly put Eugene McCarthy in. You remember this past May, there was, after Cambodia, Kent State, there was a lot of talk that tens of thousands of young people were going to get involved in the political campaigns of anti-war candidates for congressmen. And the word that came back from Washington is very few people turned up. I have a good friend, a girl from Cornell who lives in the same apartment house, who worked for Goodell, took her 6 months off from Cornell to work for Goodell, even though she's a real radical. She said it was perfectly clear that there were more people in New York City working, young people, working for Buckley, Charles Buckley, the conservative candidate, than were working for the liberal anti-war candidates. I can see why people feel discouraged that the war goes on, but I don't think people are entitled to feel discouraged. We're not in Vietnam being shot at. We're not even in prison for 3 or 5 years. We're out here able to enjoy life such as it is, and we should not be demurring at writing letters and engaging in political activity. I would like to mention picketing for certain kinds of dissent. I think it's very effective, it's dramatic, but I would confess right away to the middle class, middle-aged people in the audience, as a fellow, I can't say middle-aged, I'm considerably beyond that, but there's nothing more embarrassing. There was nothing more embarrassing to me than the first couple of times that I was on a picket line. In the first place, you're right out in public and everybody can see you. And in the second place, you're going round and round in a circle. And I would rather be in a anti-war demonstration that goes from Central Park to the UN than just keep going round and round. It seems pointless and undignified to keep going around. And every demonstration that I've been in, we've been hemmed in by police who looked disapproving, to put it very mildly. I have this daydream that someday I'm going to be involved in a demonstration in which the police are on my side and are going to be flashing victory signals at me, or this kind of a signal. What fun it would be. I may say things critical of the police. I don't think we can afford to antagonize police, to call them pigs. I think we have to recognize that they are human beings with insecurities and anxieties and resentments, and that we've got to win some of them over onto our side. Certainly anybody who's talking about a revolution, you've got to have the police and the troops, or at least an appreciable number of them, on your side. I think that it's important for us to show in various ways in different cities. University students should show up when they are striking or when they are talking about the need for higher salaries. It is one of the problems of the police. We keep them constantly anxious by keeping them in a marginal situation economically, and then reactionary forces and the people who boss them can more easily get them to take hostile positions toward young people. There's leafleting. There's something about the written word that makes it more impressive. And I thought, though I was very impressed by that Women's Lib demonstration against me in the flesh, I was even more awestruck by seeing the leaflet outside. And I think if you're leafleting the boss or the mayor or somebody else, you can be sure that he wants to get hold of a copy, just like I wanted to get hold of this copy out there. And though he can't send his secretary out I mean, he can't go out himself and pick up a leaflet. That would be undignified, but he sends his secretary out, and as soon as he gets one, you can be sure that he calls in the vice mayor or the vice president of the company, and that they read every line, wondering what is being said and wondering how many people are believing this. Then the civil disobedience, and I don't need to tell you that civil disobedience is getting increasingly dangerous as the authorities, university authorities, municipal authorities, federal authorities, harden their hearts and decide to crack down. And you can easily get not only bounced out of a university, but you can easily bounce into a jail too. I think if you are going to commit civil disobedience, terribly important to organize, to make sure that there's a large number of people and so that your leaders will be protected so they can't be cut off from you. This applies not just to students or to citizens in a municipality. I think it applies to faculty people too. One of the things that worries me is the increasing repression on the part of the federal government being exerted on universities, in which they want to come in and get at records and dictate, spy out who's a good professor from the FBI's point of view and who's a naughty professor, and the same thing about students. That kind of repression and surveillance is increasing, and I think all over America we ought to have faculty people organizing themselves, deciding where to draw the line and how to put pressure on the administration to keep the administration from too easily turning over records to federal authorities. As far as violence is concerned, as you can imagine, for a 67-year-old pediatrician, I'm not a great believer in violence. I think partly that I feel it's a somewhat dangerous way to try to bring in a new society, because so often in revolutions, once the terror is the use of terror is used, it tends to be used on people on your own side to be carried out. And this is not true in all revolutions by any means, but certainly was true of the French Revolution and the Soviet Revolution, that it postpones the true civilizing of the society after its revolution. I think more practically, what I've learned in the last 3 years is that the violence usually helps the side against which the violence is used, that the violence of the U.S. Marshals at the Pentagon, the March on the Pentagon, that radicalized hundreds of thousands of young people and some of their parents, certainly Mayor Daley's police, I believe, radicalized tens of millions of young people, particularly, and some older people. In a couple of days' time, a greater, more rapid, and more pervasive radicalism than has ever been carried out probably in the world before, because television allows you to see it. So I would always prefer to leave the violence to the other side, if I possibly can, at least until I've used all lesser means. But I think if we're honest, all of us will agree that the point comes at which we would feel that the violence used by the other side is great enough so that we would resort to violence. And an obvious example is if a thug gets in and is attacking a member of your family or your child, of course you attack him. You don't say, am I justified in using violence? But to get over to the political side, my own feeling would be that if the president, for instance, suspended the Constitution or dissolved Congress and began to throw tens of thousands into concentration camps, to me this would be a declaration of war that defied every principle of our government, and I certainly would feel absolutely free to join the revolution at that point. I think in my being extra scrupulous about revolution, I think that younger and more radical people than I might correctly say, oh, Spock, you can take this lofty view because you've always been white and you've always been middle class and you've always been comfortable. I think that would be a very legitimate criticism, because there's no doubt that our backgrounds shape our view of these things. Well, I just want to say a few more words about the Minnesota 8. I've been proud to come here today to help raise money for the Minnesota 8. I assume that they were idealistic, brave, and wise people. Just as soon as I heard about the case, and it's one of the shocking things about the communication in this country that I didn't hear about it from the time that they got into trouble back in July until somewhere around the middle of December. Not a word of it that I could see in the New York Times. And when I was asked to come, I said I would be glad to. And today I've had the privilege of spending part of the day with at least seven of the Minnesota Eight, and found them wonderful people. I think it's important in every part of the country for us to take advantage of the local opportunities to dissent and to line up with people who are fighting oppression and injustice. It's hard to get people aroused about a case in Boston or a case in Chicago, but it's the case in your own city that the rallying should be done for. These people are entitled to a very good defense. They need many thousands of dollars, not only what you will contribute tonight in coming in here, but I think that you should, if you possibly can, make future donations or make a donation beyond the dollar tonight. Remember, you're not asked to spend $1,000 or $5,000 to defend yourself. All you're asked is to give a relatively few doctors to help somebody else who's defending your position for you. I think one of the tendencies of liberal people, of course, especially older ones, is to say, but I'm not sure that I myself would have used just those particular techniques of dissent. I think this is very wrong to think in these lines. The important thing is that a horrible, titanically wrong war is still going on, and that everybody who's dissenting against that war should consider himself allies with the other people. And you should go along with whatever form of dissent seems appropriate to you. It's futile for anybody to try to dissent in a way that doesn't feel right to him inside, because he won't do it effectively. But this does not entitle you, I would say, to be supercilious about somebody else's dissent, which seems to me, you, more militant. Basically, he's fighting a terrible wrong. He's sticking his neck out way beyond how you stuck your neck out. I think in their particular case, for those who have hesitancy about the idea of going into a draft board, I like to think of the example of the Berrigans. There were two spiritual, highly idealistic priests, and there were other priests and nuns associated with them who carried out a similar act and who felt that there's no question in their mind that with the evil of the war, they were morally, spiritually, and religiously justified in doing so. And I think that we should concede to other people the same right, even though we ourselves might not want to get involved in a similar thing. Right. Injustice for black people is going to go on until more black people get militant, and until more white people who recognize the terrible injustice are going to become militant. We've got to get hold of our fellow citizens by the lapels and shake them and make them look at the terrible wrong. It's one of the most pathetic examples of how mankind fools himself that Americans keep boasting to other countries around the world how democratic we are and how freedom-loving we are. And we say this looking down our nose, criticizing other countries where we think that the democracy is less perfect, without ever realizing that for 350 years we've denied freedom and democracy to a large part of our population, meanwhile abusing them, and that it's all been illegal for 100 years. But this doesn't keep us from thinking, from most Americans thinking, that we're a marvelously freedom-loving country. They've got to be shaken, and the black militants and white militants have got to do the shaking. We have in the United States demoralizing poverty in most of our cities, and it's absolutely unnecessary. Countries only half as rich as ours, like the Scandinavian countries, long since legislated poverty out of existence. They said it isn't decent for a country that can afford to support those families that can't support themselves. It isn't decent, it isn't right for the rest to keep them in demoralizing poverty. Here we are, not only the richest country in the world, a country that's never been so rich, and still we treat poverty, horrible poverty, with total indifference. And it will continue. It isn't just the fault of the government. It's going to continue until we wake up more of our own people. Two other areas, health. The United States has more successful medical scientists. It has all the equipment. It has the means to make the most healthy nation in the world, giving every American citizen good medical care. A few Americans have good medical care, but the majority have mediocre or poor or no medical care. The AMA has been saying for years that we have the best medical care in the world, meant to be guided by science, scientific principles. But the lists of different countries in regard to morbidity to certain diseases and death rate from certain diseases like infant and maternal mortality show that the great United States stands in those different tables between 15th and 25th among the nations of the world. Absolutely unnecessary. It's a disgrace. And it's going to stay that way until we rouse ourselves and then go out and rouse our fellow citizens. Lastly, education and also pollution. Education, a minority of our kids get good education, the majority get second, third, fourth rate education. The most tragic thing is that the kids at the bottom of the barrel who need the good education most in order to get up off the bottom of the barrel are, of course, the ones who get the worst education. This is going to go on, guaranteeing that they stay at the bottom of the barrel at a poverty-stricken level until we put the kind of money into education and the kind of teachers into the schools and the kind of philosophy of education that will raise those people up. Pollution, startling statements being made now. Soon there won't be enough oxygen to breathe, as well as the befouling of our rivers and oceans, and going to turn the ocean into a sudsy bath with detergents. Absolutely horrible. And the Democratic and the Republican parties see it stylish now to talk about the environment and an end to pollution. But Richard Nixon's administration, he made a great point a few months back of saying he was proposing that a certain amount be, a pathetic number of millions be appropriated for pollution. It turned out when it was looked into that this was a small amount, smaller amount than had been appropriated during the Johnson administration. In other words, it isn't serious at all. I think as long as our two parties are dependent primarily on industry, which is, of course, the big polluter, they probably aren't going to be very serious about cleaning things up, and it's going to take an enormous exertion of pressure on the government to intimidate the government, to intimidate industry to really clean things up. To add it up, my God, we need dissent. I excuse those who feel that the country's running along reasonably well, and there's no obligation to dissent. But if you agree that these things are wrong, then you can't just be sitting and deploring things. Remember, I'm not saying you have to get involved in civil disobedience, and certainly not violence. Just pick the form of dissent that seems right to you and keep on using it. Well, you see, my views, I would like, as we get into a discussion, to have preferably the first two or three questions or remarks be made by people who feel very critical about something that I've said. Is there somebody who's been hot under the collar for a while, either that I said something they thought was wrong or that I failed to say the most important thing? Yes?
Yes, Dr. Spock, I wonder if you could comment to you. Why is it that you seem to imply, you seem to say, that if only the complexion of Congress could be changed, or if maybe Eugene McCarthy could have become president, then I think implication-wise, I think it would have been a lot better. maybe we got out of the war and we'd be on the right track and so on. Now our friend over here, Randy, at that point shouted the name Lyndon Johnson, which I took that to mean that why should you have any more confidence that the Congress or a new president would do anything more than President Johnson did to renege 3 months later on what you thought he was going to do. I just want to say one thing about that. I don't think he just means by that. I don't think Randy means by that, it's just a matter of getting good men into power. I think what I want to ask you is, do you really think that the corporate, governmental, imperialist structure of the United States can be changed by getting a different complex in the Congress?
He raises a fundamental question. He says, I seem to imply that by more people getting involved in the political process that you're going to be able to fundamentally, radically change the direction, not only in foreign policy, but in domestic policy, considering how all-powerful industry is. Well, I respect those people who say they doubt that this can be done, those people who feel that only revolution will be able to change the country. But for myself, I would say, I'm not going to concede that until I see much more effort made. And I would put it this way, that if people aren't willing to rouse themselves and make the effort, they're not going to get a revolution. Or if they do get a revolution out of people's despair, that you're not going to get anything much superior out of the revolution. What I'm saying is there's got to be heavy involvement of people, and that you first should have a try with changing the political process. One of the pathetic things about the United States is that not more than half of our people vote in any election. And this is a disgrace, this degree of indifference. Another shocking thing is that young people between the ages of 21 and 30 have had one of the poorest voting records. Now we've got the vote for 18 to 21-year-olds. And one of the big questions is going to be, are they going to have any better voting record than the 21 to 30-year-olds? It seems to me these are expressions of indifference. Now, I think if you feel for absolute sure yourself that that you've been convinced that nothing but revolution should work, then I think you're obligated to be working for revolution. I don't mean you should have to start it tomorrow, but you should be working hard. All I'm saying is everybody should be working at something instead of just wringing their hands. I want to just demur on one point, and this is an unpopular place to do it because this is Eugene McCarthy's country. I was very careful in the last political the 68 campaign never to endorse Eugene McCarthy. I always used to say, and this was a kind of a weasel-worded thing to say, those who believe in Eugene McCarthy should be working for Eugene McCarthy, and wild applause from those people who believed in Eugene McCarthy, but I never said I was working for Eugene McCarthy, partly because I didn't think he was consistently very liberal in his past voting record, and also because he had this quixotic quality, and I was scared that you let people down more by over-idealizing somebody and then having it turn out that he's nowhere near your ideal, that's more dangerous than not getting the candidate that you want. Well, anyway, I wanted, maybe that's an ungracious thing to say in the Twin Cities. All I mean is I don't want you to be implying that I was working for Eugene McCarthy. Actually, I'm working for what's called the New Party, which is trying to build itself, develop itself to the left of the Democratic Party. The only trouble is it's very small and it's so far hardly visible to the naked eye, except in certain cities. There's the nearest good, healthy branch is in Grand Forks, North Dakota, where I was speaking all day yesterday. There's a branch in Miami, a branch in Tucson, a branch in Dayton, a branch in Boston, some branches in New York, some branches around Washington. I myself believe that it's better to start a new, new party, not advocating a violent revolution, but frankly facing the fact that we have that we've got to turn from a very imperialist country into a definitely anti-imperialist country, and that we've got to restrict capitalist corporate structure and probably socialize a lot of the country. But again, this is going to take a lot of work by people. Okay, another question. No point in my repeating. Yes, gentleman in the back.
I was disturbed when you said that at a certain point I would become involved in a revolution myself. And I am disturbed at the way that you talk about changing the structure. I don't think that we can change the structure. I don't like to talk about revolution at all. I like to talk about change. And I believe that change can only come about nonviolently in the way that Gandhi and Martin Luther King did it, in specific cases to correct specific ills. The kind of fighting that was freedom fighting was the kind of fighting where mothers walked with their children to school to integrate those schools and put themselves in danger, threatening no violence to the police or the Martin Luther King.
There are lots of people who do believe that it should and could only be done effectively by without revolution. I bring up revolution because I think there's an appreciable number of young people particularly who are convinced about revolution, and I don't want to pretend that I've never heard of revolution or that it's too dirty a word to mention, especially when it's sanctified by the Declaration of Independence. I think that I was not trying to speak for everybody, but I think I was speaking for most in saying that I think most of us, even those who believe in peaceful change, would change their action if the government resorted to outrageous violence against them. At least I'm speaking for myself. Good local project. You all heard her message. Is there another question, preferably a sharp, critical one? Yes, right. You want to say something? Yeah, I'll take you next, okay? Just a minute.
Now, I just wanted to say that I hope people didn't realize or think that it was just women who are concerned with changing the sex roles and things, people becoming more militant and all that. I hope people really realize, too, that it's males who are a lot of people are also wanting to have a lot of change in the sex roles, because I think if we really look at it, like what the basis of all the society is, that it's all based upon these various male power hierarchies, these various male power structures, and this whole thing about what the war and the draft are based upon, that this, you know, it's based, you know, Dr. Spock mentioned this thing about, you know, the virility of men, the type of competition, the aggressiveness and all that, what we have going on there, these basic underlying things, which, you know, all of us live out in our own daily lives, and that the women, we also got to be changing our own lives while we're changing the society. And it's, you know, some people are really reacting and hooting at the women, you know, but like they're just being militant, because I think Dr. Spock was saying that he was going to change his book, but as part of this type of ideology, this understanding of the sexism and the sexual oppression, which is just people are just starting to come to in this country. And it was 10 years ago we started to find out about racism, and I think, and how this all related to the fabric. But now we're coming into this whole thing of understanding, like, I think how this whole, you know, sexual oppression and all that. And I think that, you know, when we can, you know, end the demand for sex roles in our own life and the way society is set up, we're going to go to a long way to ending this whole war mentality and this whole perpetuation of this whole, all these sorts of oppression.
While we're on, or speaking in a topic related to women's lib, I wanted to say I admired those women lib women who thoroughly organized this protest and took a very good occasion to make their point. I really do advocate this spirit. I thought that was a damn good demonstration. This gentleman over here.
Would you, Dr. Spock, lend your name in support of a committee to impeach President Nixon?
Oh, I'd be delighted to lend my name to that. I happen to believe, and I believed it before the election of this past fall. I've been saying it for a year and a half and speaking at universities. I think that the president is going to eliminate himself in 72. I don't say that to make anybody complacent, but I think that he is going to alienate even those people who believe in him by continuing inflation, depression, and unemployment. These are things that people cannot stand even when they're hard hat types, or maybe least of all hard hat types. Yes?
If Nixon's impeached, who'd be president?
Well, he raises a good point. If Nixon is impeached, who would be president? Do we have another question? Yes, gentleman, halfway down.
Would it change anything if he were impeached?
Well, I don't really think it would change things very much, but it might teach whoever took over a lesson that the people are really getting indignant. He gave me a note earlier. Here it is. March 3rd, Wednesday, 12 to 1 p.m., Working People for Peace, Place, First National Bank, Plaza. Do you want to read, do you want to say anything else into the microphone about this? Why don't you say a word?
Working people, last week we had a meeting downtown, and we decided that it's time the working people join the youth of this country and start mobilizing, get away from the closed rooms and the lectures. And get out in the streets. So as a first activity, the objective of this first manifestation will be to build up an independent working people mobilization, mass mobilization against the war. Already we had an organizational meeting. We're going to meet at the First National Bank Plaza, 12 o'clock, Wednesday, March 3rd. We're going to have signs, and we're going to form as long as we can single file and surround all those buildings downtown and do mass leafleting. And I urge you, if you're working, if you know working people or unemployed people, tell them to be there. It's important that this is a first thing that will happen in the Twin Cities by initiative, spontaneous initiative of working people. It's important to be a success. Thank you.
Should we take two more questions? Gentleman down there in the middle. He says if the election were to be held in 2 weeks, who would be my ideal candidate? Well, I don't have an ideal candidate. I do think we need something a little fresher than most of the candidates that are available now. One of the places I find out about the candidates is in speaking in universities, asking students about the candidates who have already spoken there. Students are very good judges. The thing that's discouraged me everywhere is when you ask, how's Muskie? All students tell me he makes a good speech, but just as soon as you ask him any questions, he begins hemming and hawing. He has certainly had a very wobbly record about the war in Vietnam, and he has drawn recently the wrath of Nader, who said he's no damn good and he's not consistent in regard to the environment, which Muskie has felt that he was an ideal knight on horseback. So I say, God deliver us from another wishy-washy president who hasn't got the guts to, or politician who hasn't got the guts to decide things. I think that George McGovern is more honest, and he certainly is more courageous to be so consistently against the war. When you come from a state where opposition to the war is not popular, he's been going very definitely against a large majority in his state, and I guess he's respected because he's such a fine person. The only trouble is, and maybe it's not fair to reproach somebody for not being what you'd like them to be, he hasn't got much charisma, and I was discouraged that when he announced his candidacy, the press said his presentation was wooden, and he sent those who've ever supported him a statement of his position. It was 16 pages, and I think this is kind of pedestrian. Well, I wish he had a little more fire. Maybe if we give him more support, he'll develop more fire. I only make the point for myself. I want to work for a new party because I don't see the Democratic Party ever becoming an anti-imperialist party or ever becoming an anti-pollution party. One more question, and then we call it a night or a day. Yes.
Thank you for the opportunity, Dr. Spock. I'd like to remind all of you that Noam Chomsky is coming to Northrop Auditorium March 6th, and in the evening there will be workshops at Vocational High School in Minneapolis. I'd like to urge you all to come and hear what Noam Chomsky has to say.
Should we? I did promise one more question. Those were both announcements. Yes. He says he's glad that I mentioned health, and he asks, how can Americans work for a system of national health such as they have in England? My own belief is that that is the only system that's really effective. Instead of bringing in some kind of a partial system where you'd still have to pay fee for service, and then the doctor is spending half his time making out chits, and the person gets the money and then turns it over to the doctor, or the doctor applies for the money for every treatment and visit. I think this is a terribly clumsy way, and it would seem to me that the only really effective way is the English system, in which you have a doctor free for everything that you need, and he is paid by the government, and he's paid in accordance with how many patients he has on his panel, up to a certain number. They don't allow a doctor to get, however popular, to get so many people on his panel that he doesn't have time to take care of the people. This is what I think we should be working for. I was trying to make head or tails of what the president's proposal was that was in this morning's paper. As usual, it comes down to letting the private sector do it, as you notice that he's going to ask the employers of the United States to set up some kind of a system. We're not going to get health for our people on any such, good health for our people on any such half-baked program as that, I believe. Thank you for your attention. Remember the Minnesota 8.